and I suddenly found myself in the kitchen on my own with Mel Gibson. And he turned round to me and he was like, do you want a cup of tea? And he said, it's PG tips. And I was like, yeah. All right, cheers, Mel. Just milk, no sugar. Thanks, mate. And a girl walked past and she had on like a kind of floaty, summery, flowered, floral pattern dress. And I said, you know what? Like, in weather like this, I sometimes think if I was a woman, that's what I'd wear. And he was like, what? And I was like, well, do you never think if you were a woman what you might wear? And he was like, absolutely not. And then at that point, Gerard Butler walked into the room. He was there also. And I was like, Jerry, what would you wear if you were a woman? And he went, fuck off.
Hello, this is your host, Graham Rooney, and welcome to A Performer, A Pint and A Pod. The podcast where I take you down the pub and we meet a performer, have a drink, and find out the tiddly truth. You only get in a pub. I'll be chatting to fantastic performers at all different points of their careers, discussing where they've come from, career-defining moments, and of course, guilty pleasures. All whilst having a laugh and getting a wee bit pissed. Fancy a pint with a pop star? A whiskey with your West End idol? Or a mojito with a magician? Then join me down the pub. So, without further ado, let's head down to the local and see which one of the nation's top performers is in there tonight. Pint, please, mate. Thank you very much. This week, I'm very happy to say I'm joined by top actor Stephen Cree. He's appeared in numerous big films, including Churchill, Terminator Dark Fate, and Outlaw King, but is also well known for starring in TV shows Outlander, Cobra with Robert Carlyle, and starring as Galloglass in the hit series A Discovery of Witches. As well as chatting about all of this, I'll of course find out about those awful audition moments and when things have gone tits up. Stephen Cree, hello and welcome to A Performer, A Pint and A Pod. How you doing, mate?
I'm very well, Graham Rooney. How are you doing?
I'm all right, mate. Thank you very much for asking. Not everyone does.
Well,
so, you know, you're already ahead there.
I'm a caring sort of person, Graham. You laugh at that as if I'm not, for some reason. What have you heard? Or what are you suggesting?
No, we've had a few games of football in it, and you were always very, very caring. It's just my jolly way that makes me laugh.
Do your listeners know that you're good at football, by the way? Have you said that, or has anyone else said that?
I've very much played down any ability I have. Pretty average.
For those listening, Graham's better. Well, he's probably less than average when it comes to like a professional footballer, but when it comes to five-a-side, you're definitely better than average, without a doubt.
Oh, mate, now you're gaining points as this podcast goes along already.
Although I haven't played with you for a few years, to be fair, so you could have dipped in talent, I guess.
Well, Jim Robinson, who was like the first podcast. He describes me quite often as a slightly overweight John Hartson now. So
a slightly overweight John Hartson.
Yeah, no. So I mean that says a lot. I think about maybe where I've gone.
I obviously haven't seen you for a few years, Graham.
Thanks, mate. Thanks. And thanks, James. But yeah. Oh dear. But what are you drinking anyway, mate?
I'm drinking a coconut flat white. Thank you very much.
A coconut flat. Well, that's very sophisticated.
Does this place do that?
Oh yes, I'm sure I can do anything for you, mate. Anything at all.
No, I was in LA once. I don't know, like 10 years ago, 2010 or something. And I don't drink alcohol, and I went into a bar. I remember, like, so it was one of the first times I'd been to LA, so I was just like, this is so cool. I'm in a pub on Sunset Boulevard, and there was a bucking bronco in the middle of the bar. I mean, where is it? You're from just outside there. Where is it you're from again?
Well, Blair Gowrie, Dundee. Yeah. So.
Blair Gowrie and Kilmarnock, you definitely did not get a bucking bronco in the middle of a pub.
No.
I'm pretty sure. And so I was sitting at the bar and the girl asked what I wanted and I was like, I think I had like a lemonade or something. And I was like, do you by chance actually have any cookies? And she was like, what, do you want a glass of milk with that? And I was like, actually, I would. I'd love one, thanks.
She was
taking the piss, but actually, they had cookies out the back. So I ended up sitting at this bar having milk and cookies.
So you're in LA, Sunset Boulevard, milk and cookies.
Milk and cookies. There you go.
Well, you see, now I tell you, no one else on a Performer Pinkton pod has ever spoken of milk and cookies in the pub.
Yeah. I've never had it anywhere else.
Well, let's get underway with your career. But before, like, I have to say, like, normally I'd go right back to the start of someone's career.
Yes.
But with you, I feel you've almost had a rebirth of your career in lockdown. Now, that is why I want to start at this new rebirth of a career of the new programme Star Force.
Oh, goodness.
Look, mate, I mean, this is amazing. This thing has exploded. You were on the Jimmy Fallon show weren't you?
I know. I mean, courtesy of Mr. McAvoy. But made it onto the Jimmy Fallon show. I think James got interviewed about it by Empire as well because he was promoting Sandman, an audio drama. And
for the people who've not seen this, give us a quick breakdown. Yeah, as you say, James McAvoy's in it, Katrina Balfe was Sam Heughan, and even Mick Foley. Mick Foley randomly is in the second episode. So
that went slightly under the radar, which I was kind of surprised and a bit upset about. So Star Force, which I'll be surprised actually if anyone listening to this hasn't watched it, because I would imagine if anyone listening to this is interested in me, there will probably be Outlander fans, and it was particularly pleasing for them because there were so many Outlander actors in it. And so it started, some of the Outlander fans seem to think I wrote it. I didn't. I will happily take credit for it, but I didn't write it. Kevin Maynes and Brendan O'Rourke wrote it, and Kevin is a mate of mine. And at the very beginning of lockdown, they did like a kind of spoof of LA Confidential, and they called it LA Noir, which was a black and white socially distanced drama, where the same in Star Force, they filmed all the scenes themselves on their phone in selfie mode, in their own houses, and then pieced it all, edited it all together like a proper little, you know, 5-minute short film.
Yeah.
I watched it and I was like, God, that's brilliant. Can I do the next one if you do one? So then they did one called Robo Night, which was a spoof kind of Robocop. in which I did an absolutely horrific German accent. Actually, do you know what? It wasn't horrific. My wife made me think it was horrific. She kept saying it sounded awesome.
Your wife, just so everyone knows, is a casting director, so she will have heard a lot of accents. So
she's very, very harsh on me as well with anything. And she kept saying it sounds a bit Austrian. And I was like, if a German accent sounds Austrian, I think I'll accept that. Like,
well, good ballpark, especially for a spoof as well.
Yeah, at least it didn't sound Portuguese or something. Although I don't think I could do a Portuguese accent. I don't know what they even sound like. Anyway, I digress. So James McAvoy saw Robo Night and he was like, that's brilliant. If you do another one, give me a shout. So I said to Kevin, I was like, listen, the game has just been upped. We've got an A-list movie star. Who wants to join the fold? So they were like, Kevin and Brendan were just like, this started as just like a little fun idea, you know, in their separate bedrooms. And then, you know, suddenly they've got James wanting to do it. So I asked Katrina Balfe if she would do it as well. And she said yes. And so Star Force was born, and it was only meant to be in the same way as Robo Knight and L.A. Noire. It was meant to be a one-off, but it went down such a storm on social media. James and Katrina wanted to do another one. So we...
I love the fact that it's now got to the point that it's not the writers or you who came in it a little bit earlier. It's now, like, you know, James McAvoy, Katrina Balfe, who are the ones going, come on, guys, we need to work on this and do another one.
No, hey, look, I know. I said, because I was saying to Kevin and Brendan, I was like, look, I don't think James or Katrina will probably want to do another one after this. But they were the ones saying, okay, like, when are we doing Star Force 2? So we got Star Force 2, and who, you know, I couldn't really do something like that without getting Sam Heughan on board, because he's kind of like, on social media in particular, Sam and I have got quite a fun sort of like banter thing going on, and I thought it'd be a good, you know, I thought it'd be funny to have him in it along with Katrina as well. And I asked Teresa Palmer, who's the female lead in A Discovery of Witches, which is a show I'm in as well. And
yes, which we will come to later on.
Most exciting of all for that, for Star Force 2, and like, all with all due respect to Teresa and Sam, Mick Foley, aka Mankind, aka Dude Love, aka Cactus Jack, I don't know about you, but when I was 16, 17, I loved the WWF, and I absolutely loved WWE, as it's called now. And I loved Mankind, and I read his autobiography in the 90s, and I just thought he was such an incredibly inspiring guy. And so it turned, I noticed on Twitter that he loves Outlander. So I tweeted him and just kind of said, oh, you know, how cool that you like Outlander. And then we started private messaging each other, and I asked him if he would fancy being in Star Force 2, and the rest is history, Graham.
Well, I mean, like you say, I think that's kind of gone a bit under the radar, and it's, I think it's maybe a generation sort of thing, but it's like, he is huge. I mean, he was up there with, like, people like The Rock, Stone Cold, Steve Austin, Hulk Hogan, Ultimate Warrior, people like that. So, totally. Like, it's amazing that you managed to get him on as well. I mean, that is such a widespread of massive, massive names of and brilliant actors and everything. And it's, I didn't realize where it had started off. That is cracking for those two guys.
He's a WWE Hall of Famer. He actually said that when his mum is such a huge Outlander fan, he said his mum would be more proud of him being in Star Force 2 than anything else he's ever achieved. Which is, and he's had books on the New York Times bestseller list along with everything else he's done. So it's quite an achievement.
It's quite an achievement, and that's quite a thing for his mum to say.
I know. God.
I don't know if that's good or brutal to him, but I mean,
I know what you mean. I'm like, my goodness.
I have to say, though, as well, for anyone listening to this who's not seen these, they are brilliant. Like, very, very funny, very daft. I mean, sort of mocked homages, spoofs of Star Trek, in which, like, you're using the microwave as buttons for.
Using the washing machine as the, you know, as the computer, or I mean one of my favorite props is Angus, who is Brendan the writer, Angus using his electric Hobbs as the sort of was it the transporter thing, I think it was.
Which, but, like, you know, it is that genius thing. That works so much better. I think on the Jimmy Fallon show, James McAvoy was sort of saying, we started to get too clever and it kind of ruined the comedy because our props were getting too good. So yeah, it was like, no, get back to the washing machine.
That's what James was saying. We had to try not to be too good. I think some people understood that as like we had to try not to be too good at acting or something. Although there's also a fine line with that in it as well. If like if you try and do like a really, really, really cracking authentic performance, it's not going to work either. So like it has to be, I mean, mate, you know, you do sketch comedy.
Yeah.
It's got to be done with a sort of like wink wink to the, you know, to the audience as well. But also you've got to be in it as well.
That it's such a weird thing, because you're like that, you're like, I can't, it, I don't want authenticity. I don't want beautiful authenticity as an actor.
No.
But at the same time, I don't want to just look crap as well. Like, I've got to be like, this fine balance.
It's a fine line. It's a
which
fine
you,
line.
In your wonderful yellow shorts and ridiculous makeup, I feel really mastered, I have to say.
Thank you. I mean, I thought, even if I'm like, even if I don't master that, then the makeup will carry me through. So, you know, I got a lot of people seem to think my 2-year-old daughter did my makeup. My wife did my makeup. I mean, I don't know if that's an insult to my wife's makeup or my 2-year-old being some sort of genius, but she doesn't quite have the coordination yet.
If a 2-year-old had done that, that would be something. You would be genius school coming for her. What I was going to say on this, first of all, if you've not seen it, anyone listening to this, go watch it. You can catch it on YouTube, can't you?
Yeah, it's on YouTube and
Star Force.
Yeah,
it will come up.
It's, and the third one is in production as well. I'll just add, Graham, there is.
Oh, you've beat me to the question. M Torek, she had sent a wee tweet, and she was like, "Is there going to be a trilogy?" But there we go.
There is, and we've got another two very big guest stars for the third one. Don't want to say who they are, just in case they pull out, but they have said they would do it. One of them's an Oscar nominee, Graham. So,
Star Force. I was just about to say, I can confirm it's not me. It's not me, guys. But you've got an Oscar nominee for Star Force.
Yeah. So it's just going from strength to strength until everyone loses the will to live.
Well, you know, you've got to know where to draw the line. You know, you don't want to be fast and furious and doing 10 of them or something like that. You know, you don't want to overdo it. Or
especially since we're not earning about 10 million a movie, which I assume The Rock must be by Fast and Furious 10.
Yeah, but it's that thing. You never want to go too far and be remembered for that. You want to be remembered for the beauty and the artistry of the initial idea.
Exactly. To be honest, I think Star Force 2 will be hard to beat, but Star Force 3 has certainly got a stellar cast, so maybe that will be the last one, but you never know.
Well, I do, honestly, people should have a watch of this, and I think it's brilliant that you've got another, like, it just seems to be going up and up and up every time. And those guys can't believe it, that they started this. They'll want more lockdowns. Like, they were right.
Oh, no, I think it's Kevin's, you know, Kevin. I was like, you know, I'm kind of the casting director of it, because I've been the one, you know, asking a lot of the people to get involved. But it's almost like we've been aiming so high, and the bar has been set so high now. It's like, you know, by Star Force 4, anything less than Brad Pitt probably won't really do.
Right. If you get Brad Pitt, then, like, you've got to come back on here and tell me all about the filming for Star Force 4. Because that'd be unbelievable.
That would be quite something.
Right, well, I tell you what, we will move on. As much as I'd love this whole podcast to be a Star Force podcast, I think with the tweets that I've had, we'll have to move on to Outlander.
No bother.
So let's have a quick chat about Outlander. You said, obviously, Mick Foley is a huge fan.
Yeah.
It is. it's one of those things that's it's just been huge. I don't know if you expected or any sort of idea of what it was going to be like when you got the role. How has it been for you since that audition? And what was the audition like?
I went in and it was with Suzanne Smith and went into the room. I had the sides, the pages that we read for the audition had come in. And I'd read the character description, and I actually thought, you know, sometimes you get some auditions come in, and you think, yeah, I could, you know, I think I could be a pretty good fit for this part. I went in, did the audition with Suzanne. She gave me a couple of notes. You know, I think maybe I was a little bit serious at first. She told me to keep it a little bit lighter, bit more smiley. Told me not to do because Ian Murray's got one leg, so I was like, should I limp about? And she was like, no, don't do any limping acting. Like, okay.
Oh no, because that's my speciality. Damn it.
I know. I'm great at limping. And did that, and I'm pretty sure I didn't hear anything for about 3 weeks. And sometimes with American stuff or bigger stuff like that can happen. Weirdly, when you're in America auditioning for stuff, anytime I've been to LA, you hear very, very, very quickly if they're interested, but over here it's different. Yeah. And didn't hear anything. And I remember actually when I first heard it, I was lying on my sofa in Canary Wharf, where I used to share a flat with my old flatmate, Barry McGee, who I went to drama school with, and don't know if you know Barry, and I was lying on my flat in my city, feeling a little bit as not all actors, because all actors haven't experienced this, but most actors will know, lying on my sofa thinking, ah, fuck this. Like, I am so bored of these peaks and troughs of acting and, you know, having a bit of a busy spell and then nothing, and I had no motivation that day. You know, I was just lying there feeling a bit sorry for myself. And an email popped up on my phone from my agent saying, you know, it's looking good for Outlander. You know, they're really interested, just waiting for, I don't know, Stars or Sony or something to, you know, like say, okay. And I was like, oh, wow. That's cool.
So is this life. That I think that says everything right there.
Yeah, totally. And then I got, so then like about a week later or something, I got offered the part. But you know, weirdly, mate, the strange thing was I wasn't on social media at that point. I knew Outlander was based on books, but
yeah,
I didn't know anything about it. And as I've said before as well, and publicly, so it's fine, Sam and I at that point both, I thought Sam was a dick and Sam thought I was a dick as well, seemingly. And so like the fact that he had been cast as the lead and it was to play his best friend, I was also a bit like, not sure how excited I am about the prospect of that. And then as sod law would have it in this industry as well, I also got offered at the same time a small part in a BBC film called Marvelous, which I thought the script was absolutely incredible for that. And it ended up winning a BAFTA and Toby Jones won a BAFTA. So
right.
I was right about it. So, and it was maybe going to clash. And I was like, look, if it clashes, I really, really want to do the film. And my agent was like, Outlander's going to be like a really big, possibly continuing TV series. And I was like, well, like, cool, but, you know, I think the film's going to be really, really interesting. And the film was paying very, very little money compared to Outlander as well. But I just, do you know what? I really genuinely didn't understand the scope of Outlander at that point. Anyway, they both worked out, fortunately. I was able to do them both. And then when I went to get my wooden leg fitted for Outlander,
Your limp acting in.
Finally get the old limp acting in. That's when I realised that this show was like going to be really big and the production values were really big. And it was far larger in scale and scope than any other TV production.
I think that's what I noticed, like, when I've been watching it, is that it is amazing production values.
Totally.
But like you say, because obviously, being Scottish, being an actor myself as well, it was one of those things that every Scottish actor was kind of hearing about when it was kind of like the first rumblings of it. But I don't think anyone really truly knew what was going to happen with it. It's certainly, like, you know, I mean, for Sam and Katrina, I mean, like you say, on social media, it's been an explosion. They've got millions of people following them because it's just a massive hit.
I didn't really realize. I remember specifically, and I think I've said this before, maybe at conventions, I remember having a chat with Katrina on set just before the first episode aired. And by that point, I was convinced that the show was going to be a really, really big success because it had all the elements that shows at that time were being successful for, like period drama, you know, like the amazing production values, a bit of fantasy, you know, romance. And so I thought, you know, shows like Downton Abbey and Game of Thrones, etc., I thought it will definitely be very, very popular. I didn't know that it would be so critically well received. You know, the fact that it's had so many Golden Globe nominations and stuff is amazing as well.
Yeah.
And then the thing that you can't predict, and I don't, you know, no one knew this, it has become like a real global phenomenon. The show itself, I think the fans of the show sometimes think that maybe the show changed my life or changed my career or something. It didn't change my career in that sense. It's not the sort of show for me, and the sort, and also as you will know, it wasn't really very, very big in the UK for the first 2 or 3 years.
No, you know, definitely. And I don't know if that's like maybe because of like Prime was on as it wasn't on a main channel as well, and that's a big thing in the UK, sort of for a show to really take off over here.
Totally. I think that was a big factor, and. So it wasn't like, and also I don't have the same sort of high impact part in it like Sam or Katrina or Tobias. I mean, I've actually only been collectively in about 9 episodes over the 5 seasons. So it wasn't like I did it and then suddenly my career changed. Like I did it and then I was unemployed again for a while, you know.
and welcome back. It's back to the sofa.
And I wasn't walking into auditions here and people were like, oh wow, so you're an Outlander. In fact, actually there was almost a kind of strange negativity about it in the UK. But what it has done over the years, and it's difficult to say what impact it's had in my career because you don't know the conversations that go on behind closed doors when you get a part, but you know, being part of all the fan conventions and you know, that side of it is like a whole other, it's almost like a separate career in a way, but also it's like, you know, I've got a lot of followers, well, not compared to Sam and Katrina, but relatively quite a lot of followers on social media as well, simply because I'm sure of Outlander, and because of that I've been able to raise quite a lot of awareness for various charities. And been invited to conventions in New York, Rome, Germany, Spain, Texas, Blackpool. You know, and you meet fans from, when you go to these conventions, literally there are fans from basically every continent apart from Antarctica. It's incredible in that sense.
Well, I mean, that's it. It's, the strange thing is like, if you do search your name on YouTube, I did notice a lot of it is you on a stage with a microphone rather than a lot of the time you'll search an actor's name and obviously it's clips here and clips there. But you say, it's all of these conventions that you're doing and you a lot of the time doing stuff with Sam as well because the two of you get up to stuff basically.
Yeah, it's actually that aspect of it is a little bit embarrassing because when you're doing the conventions, I never, ever, 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 ever think of the fact that anyone else is going to see what I'm talking about or what I'm doing on stage. And I do talk I mean, the fans who have been to conventions will attest to this. I talk absolute shit. And I go into
that's why I got you on the podcast.
Well, there you go.
That was like guaranteed rubbish. Bring them on.
I've talked 34 minutes of pish so far.
Well, as you say, actually, you know what? Like, we'll move on from Outlander a bit then, because I think it's very interesting what you say about it not being a career change for you. What would you say? Is there something either in your life or in your career that you would say that was the thing?
Yeah, I tell you what Outlander did do, in the sense of it's, you know, getting a part in a show like that, so getting like an actual, you know, decent part, not one of the outright leads, but a good supporting part. Getting a part in a show like that makes you think, ah, okay, so that's possible then. So then that little chink in your brain goes, ah, okay, so I can get that. Because, you know, you go up for those sort of parts and you do self-tapes and you go in for those auditions again and again and again and again. And especially when you're not meeting the directors or the producers or anything, you know, they just disappear into the ether and you think, is there any point in even doing these? You know, and there's so many permutations. And, you know, I'm married to a casting director, so I really, 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 really see behind the curtain. There's so many permutations towards getting a part, and it's so arbitrary. And I know, you know, and I know, and you'll have had this, I'm sure, as well. I know that I've done, you know, that 100% the best audition I possibly could have done. And you can be the best person in the room and you can have done the best audition, but you still won't get the job because, you know, there's other things at play. And so it kind of like that, it helped in that sense going forward, like, okay, that's possible. But I think the thing that mentally really changed everything for me, And again, this didn't, like, you know, it wasn't like the floodgates opened and I had some sort of like overnight success or anything. But when I was 27 and I'd been out of drama school for 6 years and I'd worked very, 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 very sporadically, like, you know, one job a year, sometimes one job every 18 months, you know, so working in bars, restaurants, offices, everything in between. And then when I was 27, I got one of the lead parts in a West End musical called Cabaret in London, the West End of London. And that was a job that changed everything, in the sense that so I was 27 at that point, I'm 40 now. So very, 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 very fortunately, I haven't had to do any work outside of acting since that. So, you know, it changed in that sense. But I think because as a kid growing up in Kilmarnock, my dream had been to go to London and do musicals. And that's what I wanted to do. It was always musicals that I really, really wanted. Musicals are still like my big passion, actually. But and when I got that part, like, not only did that kind of cap off like a literal childhood dream of something that I wanted to do, it also made me think again, in the same way as getting that part in Outlander, it made me think, ah, okay, so this is possible then. You know, I actually can have, because at that point I thought, I will never, ever, ever have a career in acting. Like, it just doesn't, I was like, that's obviously something that happens to other people and it's not going to happen to me. And it wasn't, I still believed in myself. I still thought I can do this. I just didn't seem to be getting either the breaks or the opportunities or, you know, whatever. And so that changed everything. And then I just absolutely loved it. It was an amazing, phenomenal, incredible job. And I just felt I did that for about 10 months. So 10 months on stage in the West End playing such a good part, I just felt like I learned so much. And I came out of it like 100 times more confident than I was before. Because probably, I guess, maybe you'll have had similar experiences where when you go for a long, long time without work, my confidence completely and utterly went, you know.
I think even when you don't know it yourself, that there is like you give off a different energy when you go into an audition when you've been working for loads, or if you, like you say, for a year, all you've been doing is auditioning. So you can't help that there'll be this energy coming into a room. Here we go again.
Totally. Completely. And no matter how chilled out or relaxed or undesperate you try to feel, you're going in. And back then as well, for me, auditions were very, very few and far between. You know, so I would maybe get... I'd maybe get an audition once every 3 months or something, or, you know, it wasn't... They weren't coming in thick and fast. So you put a lot of pressure onto getting that one, you know, that one audition. And it's difficult. It's tough. I mean, that's the toughest part of the industry, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly spot on what you were just saying there. A lot of people talk about, oh, I've got a lot of auditions and stuff. When you've only got that one audition every 3 months, and you do, you really put that pressure on yourself before you go through the door.
Totally.
But when I get asked about auditions and what I should do, from younger actors at drama school and everything, I always say what you said earlier on, which is all you can do is your utter best. If you just go into the dish, forget about getting the part or getting it, because there's loads of reasons and you won't know why. And just make sure that you go in and do your best, 100% your best acting, because then you can't beat yourself up. That's what you'll beat yourself up for. When you leave an audition and you'll have had this yourself and you know you've farried up something, or you've only gone 70% for some reason.
Although, funnily enough, you can do that and you can come out of it thinking, I fucked that up, and then you get the part. And then you can come out... You can come out thinking... Look, 100%, there's a film in particular, and I won't say what it was, but there's a film in particular I know that I did some of, if not the best work I think I've ever done, actually. And, I had a screen test for it and everything, and I was basically told it was my part. I was told it was my part, and I didn't get it. And that's another story that a lot of actors have had as well, by the way. And that's very common. I'm not saying that to you. I'm saying that to anyone listening. And I didn't get it. And that can be gutting as well, because you're like, oh, I think some of the best work I've ever done was in audition rooms or on self-tapes, and no one's ever going to see it anyway. But then... that's another thing about acting as well. You have to try and, you don't want it to always be about for everyone else. You know, it's got to be for yourself as well. So in a way, harking back to what you just said, as long as you do the best work that you can, then, fuck that. Fuck that. You want to get the job. I'm scrapping that, Graham. I'm scrapping that. You want to do the best work you can and get the job as well. I'm done with being spiritual.
But there you go, that straight quote from Stephen Key's mouth there. upcoming actors, stuff it. No matter what, just get the job. However you get the job, just get it. Forget about the acting. Just get the job.
Don't even be your best. Just get the job.
Just go in with a wad of cash. Put it down. Yeah. Pick me. That'll do. Forget it. Forget about the auditioning. Oh, brilliant. Actually, talking about auditions, this is what I love to hear from, because we've all got those stories. What is the worst audition that you've had?
Oh, God, right. I've had two particularly horrific ones, and I don't know which one to go with, and I don't want to name names either.
Oh, mate, go with both. Let us hear both. This podcast loves a bad audition story.
Okay, I'll go with both. Well, one of them, I had a lot of commercial castings in my early days for adverts, commercials, and a couple of them I cried in, but because I did so many of them and never got them, and they're so humiliating, so soul destroying. There were a couple I was in once. One was for a furniture ad, and they told me what I had to do, and then I stood. And I just quietly started sobbing. And I was like, I'm going to have to leave the room. And they were like, are you okay? And I was like, no, I'm not okay. Because in that particular point, I thought, I cannot do this anymore. I'm going to have to quit acting. If I have to stand here and pretend that I like a piece of fucking furniture, to people sitting nodding and going, you know, and giving you horrendous direction. It's like that. What's that thing on YouTube? Flaming Hawk or something?
Yes.
Fiery Hawk.
Fiery Hawk.
I mean, my God.
It says everything. That is actually, actors watching that are a bit like, well, it's almost like a documentary, really.
That is commercials.
Yeah.
Right, anyway, first story. First one. So couple of years after I finished Cabaret musical, I got brought in for a general meeting with a casting director. And general meeting, for anyone listening, is just like you go in and just have a chat. It's not an audition. It's just so that the casting director gets to know you, you get to meet them, and they have a chat about your career or whatever, and maybe they will think of you for future projects. So I went in, had a chat, and the casting director was like, oh, do you want to meet my my mum, who was also a casting director? And I said, oh, we met, actually. She came to see the show I was in a couple of years ago. So went to meet her, and she was like, we've never met before. And I said, no, we have. We met a couple of years ago. And she was like, no, we didn't. And I said, yeah, you came to see the show that I was in. And, you know, we went out for dinner afterwards. She was like, I've never met you in my life. So I was like, oh my God, this is horrendous. And like, you know, it was really already the ground was starting. I wanted the ground to swallow me. And I was like, you came to see Cabaret. And she said, I've seen Chicago, but I've never seen Cabaret. And I was like, I don't know what to say, but I'm not making it up. And then she was like, oh, I do remember. And I was like, oh. And she said, yeah. She said, I remember because the night after we saw your show, my husband had a stroke. And I was like, oh, God. I hope it was nothing to do with my performance. And she went, what? And I was like, and I was just like, oh, no, fuck. I just didn't know what to say. So then she started explaining the process and how it had been, like, really emotional and a tough time and stuff. And, again, I didn't know what to say. So after she finished speaking, I just went, yeah, that's mental. And she looked at me and went, yes, mental. And then there was just sort of silence. And I was like, I'll just go. She was like, yeah. I was like, okay. So I left the room. I've never met them since. That was pretty excruciating.
There is so many elements to that. Because, I mean, the worst thing is when you go into a casting director and either, like, you know, they'll say hello and remember you, and if you've not remembered them, that can be terrible. Or like vice versa, like you've just had there, and you just had to keep going. And then for the reason to be, oh, mate.
I know. And I don't think, you know what, they probably won't remember it now, to be honest. And it wasn't like, afterwards I thought, why did I keep insisting that we had met? I thought I should have just shut up. But then also, I couldn't understand what was going on. But anyway, I weirdly then had something so similar a couple of years later, where I did a workshop of a play. And so, again, for anyone listening, the play was kind of semi-written, and they got some actors in to talk through, to kind of work through the play and see if you could come up with any ideas, and for the writer to see what worked and what didn't work. And the play didn't even have a name at this point, so we were all suggesting names for the play. And then a few weeks later, I went to audition for it with the director. And I walked in and I was like, hey, everyone, how you doing? Nice to see you again. And the director went, we've never met. And I was like, oh, my fucking God, not again.
And the most forgettable actor in history.
I was like, I know, jeez. So I was like, we just did the workshop of the play a few weeks ago. And he was like, no, I haven't met you before. And I was looking at the other people in the room like, what? So then the writer was in the room, and I said to him, oh, And I am sure that he chose the name that I suggested for the play. So I said, oh, I see you went with, you know, the idea that I said or whatever. And he was like, no, that was my idea. And I was like, right, okay. And then the director said, shall we just read? And I said, yeah. And so say we had like 3 pages to read. I think I got about a paragraph into it. And the director said, okay, thanks. I was like, okay. And then I just slowly walked out the room. And yeah, that was pretty brutal.
That was it. And I can't believe that. Because a workshop, yeah. Like, what?
The workshop was it, 2 hours? 4 days.
Yeah, no. Workshop, yeah. At minimum, is a half day. And like, yeah. Like you say, but what? They just completely forgot you, took your title, and then of all of that, and then forgetting you, they'll have thought that you were the dick because you were this random guy coming in going, hey, I told you what the title was. Completely. You should remember me.
Completely. So yeah, and that was also a time as well when acting work was, you know, not coming that thick and fast. So I was fairly gutted by how badly it went. But now it's just a story on a podcast, so it's all good.
Well, that's the whole thing, mate. Like, you know, it just shows. For any young actors listening, that you can cry in an advert audition, you can be forgotten when you were on the West End stage by a top casting director, and you can do a workshop with a director, come up with a show title and be forgotten again, and still go on and have a fantastic career.
And look, so, and that's the thing about. I thought I was pretty good in that West End show as well. Like, it was a pretty big part. And to be completely forgotten.
Yeah, that's really amazing. To be forgotten. Like, someone comes and sees you for a couple of hours. And you said you went for dinner afterwards as well.
Yeah. We went for dinner as well. Totally forgotten.
Mate, you are Mr. Cellophane of the acting world.
But you just keep going.
But it's good. I mean, look. Like, you look through your career and it's just as well you did. I saw you on Cobra. That was another one which I'm sure you must have loved.
Oh, I loved it.
Being part of. You had a cracking bit. If anyone's not seen Cobra, that was on Sky. Robert Carlyle was the Prime Minister. And was it a meteor was coming to Earth, and because all the power got cut?
Yeah, so there was going to be a kind of storm in space, and they were worried that it was basically completely and utterly on something that could happen, and they were worried that it was going to knock out some of the basically communication satellites, and therefore have like a devastating effect on the power grid across Europe and the UK, and so basically the worst happened. And the power got completely knocked out in the UK and various parts of Europe. And then they managed to get the power back on in the big cities like London and Manchester. But, you know, like large swathes of Britain were in complete darkness for, you know, a long period of time. Now, actually, funnily enough, when we filmed that, and actually I read a couple of the reviews when it came out this year, and a couple of them suggested that it was a little bit far-fetched. And then suddenly we got hit by a worldwide pandemic. And you realise that actually it wasn't far-fetched enough.
I think that's the thing with the worldwide pandemic, and you watch a film like Contagion, and you sort of go, oh, everything in that is exactly spot on. This pandemic has made things, like you say, a lot more believable. You were the head of, what was it, the head of the police at the north in the northeast.
I was the chief constable for, Tyneside. Was it Teesside or was it Tyneside or up there anyway in the northeast? I was the chief constable somewhere up there. It was it was cracking. I mean, I thought when I read the first episode of that, I absolutely loved it, and I was desperate to find out what happened next. So that's always a good sign. But I genuinely had no idea, because I'd only read episode one. I didn't realise how good my part was going to get and how involved in it was. And I kind of had my own separate, almost like my own separate storyline going on, in a way. It kind of felt like, in a way, I was of my part of the storyline. I kind of always felt a bit like I was the lead character of that particular story. Apart from when I was in scenes with Robert Carlyle, obviously, and so that was amazing, because that was a big step. I felt quite nervous before my first day, and I felt quite a bit of pressure, because that was the first time really I'd played a part like that on TV. And so it felt like a bit of a step up. And well, getting to, like, the cast were amazing. Richard Dormer is such a good actor. Robert Carlyle, maybe you're the same, but Robert Carlyle is just such a, you know, being Scottish as well, always been such a big hero of mine.
Yeah, he's Hall of Fame. Yeah. I mean, totally. Like, and especially our era growing up, Begbie.
Yeah.
Iconic. Yeah. Absolutely iconic.
Oh, completely iconic. And a nicer guy you could not meet and to work with as well. He wasn't what I was expecting, actually. I knew it, like, my wife had worked with him and stuff, so I knew a bit, but he was just so great, and such a great laugh. And I think both being Scottish as well, and being the two Scottish people on it, we got on great. And I loved that job. Really, really, really loved it.
Oh, well, that is good to hear, because I was going to ask you how it was working with him and working with a bit of a hero. I mean, I don't think you could be an actor of our generation and not have Robert Carlyle as a bit of a hero. Those Trainspotting lads. I mean, you had Trainspotting and Braveheart were kind of like this mid-90s huge iconic films.
I did actually talk about it. I met Mel Gibson once in Malibu.
Did you?
I was at this is quite very random. I was at a barbecue at my friend's house in Calabasas, which is just near Malibu, and she had like a ranch, and she knows a lot of very successful actors in kind of Hollywood and around that, and she was having a barbecue, and Mel Gibson was there, and I suddenly found myself in the kitchen on my own with Mel Gibson, and I was like, oh fuck, I better not mention Braveheart. So he turned round to me and he was like, do you want a cup of tea? And I was like, and he said, it's PG tips. And I was like, yeah. All right, cheers, Mel. Just milk, no sugar. Thanks, mate.
That's my favourite.
That's fantastic. My favourite. And he was like, and then this actually, fun enough, this is something that I have thought of before. And a girl walked past and she had on like a kind of floaty, summery, floral pattern dress. And I said, you know what, like, in weather like this, I sometimes think if I was a woman, that's what I'd wear. And he was like, what? And I was like, well, do you never think if you were a woman, what you might wear? And he was like, what are you talking about? I said, well, I think a lot of things, you know. There's loads of things I'll go through my life not knowing what it's like to be. Now, you know, I'm never going to know what it's like to be an astronaut. You know, I'll, like, just various different things. And I was like, I just sometimes think, you know, particularly in the summer as well, we can wear shorts and t-shirt, you know, but I was like, women can wear like nice floral pattern floaty dresses. And he was like, I've got no idea what you're talking about. And I was like, are you telling me you've never in your life thought what you might wear if you were a woman? And he was like, absolutely not. And I was like, but, and then I remembered he did that film, What Every Woman Wants.
I know, that's what I was like, in my head.
So then I pushed him on it. I thought, I'm not going to let this go. So I pushed him on it a bit more. I was like, come on. It's just me and you. What would you wear? He said, well, all right, okay. I'd probably just stay in the house all day naked. And I was like, that's a really boring answer. And then at that point, Gerard Butler walked into the room. He was there also. And now I don't know him. And I was like, Jerry. And he said, yeah. And my friend who had invited me to the party was by this point in the room. looking at me, thinking, what the hell is he talking about? And I was like, Jerry, what would you wear if you were a woman? And he went, fuck off. And I was like, all right, okay. I might have been better just saying, listen, Mel, I thought you were great in Braveheart, but anyway.
I think that might have been the better option.
Wouldn't have been as good a story.
It wouldn't have been at all. I'm so glad it actually turned to you pressing him on the fact, because it's like, hold on a minute. You were in that Where Every Woman Wants film. So you must have thought about it. Where was your, like you know, you must have done research on what women wear. And you must have thought it at some point then.
I think it's because there was truth behind it as well. I think those like lovely floral pattern summer dresses look nice. I imagine they're quite refreshing to wear in the summer. And you know what? I could wear one if I wanted to, I guess, really. I just don't.
I love it. Your wife's going to come back after this podcast and you're just going to be sitting in a nice baggy floral dress.
Well, she knows. She knows. Like, she will sometimes buy floral pattern stuff because she knows that I love a nice floral pattern dress.
Do you know what, actually, though? We did talk about Bad Edition. What I do love to talk about in this podcast as well, you've obviously done quite a bit of stage. You've done the West End. You did Macbeth, didn't you, at the National Theatre?
Yep.
Talking about stage.
Yeah.
Have you ever had it where it's gone completely tits up for you?
I mean, like, several times. I think the best probably...
A serial... Like, fuck up.
Oh, yeah. I think the best was on Cabaret, but I do remember once playing, which I'll tell you, so when I did Cinderella, a pantomime at the Hackney Empire in London in 2007, and I was playing Prince Charming. And as a side note, the Financial Times review of that, and you always remember the bad ones, it gave it a brilliant review. And it said, like, the cast basically was spectacular, apart from Stephen Cree, who was radically miscast as Prince Charming and would be more at home on the Glasgow Clydeside shipyards as a welder.
Oh!
I mean, so not only did they get in a little bit of xenophobia there against the Scottish, which actually, to be fair, you see that in theatre reviews a bit. I remember seeing it last year in a review of something.
I remember Star Force star James McAvoy picking up on that, actually.
Quentin Letts, the irrepressible bellend. If it wasn't Quentin Letts, I'm sorry, Quentin Letts, but I feel like that's who it was.
Love that.
I feel like it was somebody like that. And... radically, like, to suggest that you were radically miscast as Prince Charming is implying that you are without charm whatsoever. Quite brutal.
Oh, well, I mean, that is very brutal, and especially since they complimented the show as well, to sort of take it aside and then brutally hit you with it.
To add insult to injury, like, the only reason I saw this review was because that show in particular, they put all the good reviews outside the stage door as you walked in. So they'd actually stuck it up on the stage door and I had to walk past it every single day. That actually is pretty shit, I think.
You know, when I
look back on it. But you know what? I've gone on and, you know, had a good career anyway, so fuck them. and on that show in particular, I was standing backstage, maybe this is why I got a bad review, I was standing backstage speaking to one of the costume people, and then I heard the entrance music for Prince Charming. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I didn't know anyone else in the show who's got that music as well. And I was chatting away, I was like, so listen, da-da-da-da-da, and then the music played again, and I was like, fuck, it's me. So I bolted down the stairs, bolted onto the stage, bolted down the stairs. It was like the prince's big entrance, bolted down the stairs. All the cast were looking at me like, where the hell have you been? And I ran down. I was like, oh, princess or whatever. What was her name? Cinderella, sorry. Cinderella. And I could not stop laughing. I completely and utterly corpsed. And then me and Cinderella go straight into a duet.
Oh, no.
And it was a, can't remember what it was. It was a song originally written. And I couldn't stop laughing as I was singing, which is just, I mean.
That's impossible. You're done then. You can't laugh and sing.
And you know, the funny thing about pantomime is the audience kind of loves it when the actor corpses, but this was a miserable, miserable experience of a pantomime, I have to say. Everyone took it. I mean, it is, you've got to take these things seriously, but the girl playing Cinderella was so pissed off with me, and everyone else was so pissed off, and it was like there was so much backstage backstabbing on that show. Like, the actors were so, and this is the thing that, you know, non-actors might find interesting and actors will know. Like, you know, I remember the guy playing Buttons at the start of that said, listen, by the end of this, you'll be walking past backstage and the end of the donkey will be having stand-up fights with the front of the donkey. It kind of was like that. There was so much bitterness and kind of hatred backstage. It was very, very vile. And anyway, that was bad. But better than that, I think, is when I did Cabaret, and there's a really powerful moment in Cabaret where I played Cliff, who's the American that comes to Berlin, and in this version, I got captured by the Nazis, and they start to beat me up. So like they hit me with a truncheon and they punch me in the face and they kick me. And Sean Hackett, his name is, I'm still friends, Sean was one of the dancers in the show. Sean had this bit where he had to run up and kind of hit me with a truncheon, I think.
Right.
Stage hit, obviously. And so it's a very, very, very serious bit of the show. The Nazis are just starting to really, come to serious prominence in Berlin. And we all know the history. And Sean runs up to hit me, and as he ran, he slipped, like it was like a cartoon, like a banana skin slip, and he went up in the air and landed on his arse. And the other two Nazis who are holding me still, we all of us just absolutely crumpled in laughter. I mean, there was no, we just couldn't stop. And it's so weird, you're on stage in front of I don't know how many people the Lyric Theatre holds, 800, 1,000 maybe. And I think as well, we've been doing the show for a few months by that point, so you're quite relaxed.
That's the danger.
And it's like when you're at school and you get to, you know that you cannot laugh because the teacher's going to go ballistic at you, but you cannot stop laughing. And we couldn't stop laughing. And they kind of like, I then go straight into a scene with a German Ernst, who was played by Michael Beckley of Home and Away fame. And Michael played this really stern, harsh German who I've become friends with, but I've just started to realise he's a Nazi. In fact, I think it's after this point I realise he's a Nazi. And I go straight into that scene and I'm still laughing, and I was looking upstage thinking, maybe the audience can't tell. And then Ernst starts speaking to me and I can't remember what my lines were at all, but I was just like, Ernst, I looking up stage, and he started laughing as well, and he lost it.
See, that's it. You need the other person to hold it together. If they go, then you're done.
It was an utter shit show. So anyway, we eventually managed to get it back together, but unfortunately, For the next 4 or 5 performances, every time it come up to that bit, as Sean was about to hit me, we would catch each other eye and start laughing again because we knew what had happened. I can picture it in my head and it still makes me laugh to this day. And it was something about, as I say, it was such a serious, heavy moment in the show as well.
I think this is the thing a lot of people don't realise, you know, West End actors, professional shows, people have worked very hard in their career to get there, and so often, some of the most serious moments Like people will absolutely piss themselves laughing, actors on stage, and all you can do is look down or turn your back in the audience, try and find an angle so that you're not looking at the audience and somehow try and get it back together. Because what happens, like you say, when you're nervous, when it just starts, when the show's just begun and your previews and that's not happening. Like, you know, you're very focused. But you just have that little bit of relaxation that sets in once you're really comfortable in the role and what you're doing. And one thing sets you off and that's it. Yeah, you're done. It's a nightmare.
And it is. It's funny. There's something about relaxation. About 6 months into that show as well, I remember being on stage one night and I turned to Angela Richards, who was playing Fräulein Schneider, and I turned and I was like, oh my God, I cannot remember my next line at all. And not only could I not remember my next line, because I'm quite good at improvising, so I'll normally work my way out, my head went blank. I couldn't even think to speak. And she looked at me, but because Angie was quite bad for forgetting her lines, so she thought it was her. So she looked at me with kind of fear in her eyes, but she became a master at disguising it. So then she just started speaking. And I knew I had more lines after that. And I just looked at her blankly. So she was like, come on, Cliff, come on. And like kind of ushered me off stage. And I came off stage and I was like, aye. And she came off and she was like, oh my God, Stephen, I'm so sorry. I can't believe I did it again. I said, like, don't worry, Angie, it was me that time.
I love the way she ushered you off stage, almost like a broken actor as well.
Yeah,
because it was just like walking you off because you'd lost all ability in walking, speaking, anything.
So it's so weird. That's the only time that's ever happened to me, actually. But God, that is scary.
That is. I've not spoken to anyone yet where it's not even happened, just that once.
Yeah, horrendous. Horrendous. But yeah. It all worked out in the end.
There we go. Well, that's the world of an actor there. Oh, God. Time is getting on. What we'll talk about then, just quickly before we get to the end of the podcast, is some upcoming stuff for you. Now, obviously, there was a Discovery of Witches.
Yes.
Which, is it Gallo Glass? Is
Gallo that Glass. The... Gallo Glass.
As the character you are in that. Can you tell us just a quick little bit about the program and your
Gallo Glass is a fucking legend. That's basically he's a vampire and he's a legend.
I believe it. That's what it says on IMDb as well.
Yeah. So Gallo Glass is a vampire and a kind of soldier of fortune who's been alive since about the 12th or 13th century. And he's a best friend and also nephew to Matthew, the lead character in the show, who's played by Matthew Good. And anyway, so he's my uncle, and I'm very, very, very loyal to his family. And he's also described he's described in the book as like a bit of a giant. He's described as like a kind of Viking, blonde, blue-eyed vampire, kind of like very muscular. Kind of giant of a guy. Now, obviously, I'm not a giant, Graham, as you know, but I've been quite amused. I've been quite amused and also, but I think I fit the character well. I've been quite amused and also bemused by some of the comments that I see on a, and this has never, ever, 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 ever bothered me on anything ever before, but it's hard not to see comments these days because of social media. And I'm on Twitter and I'm on Instagram. Most people are very, very happy and supportive of the casting, but he's a very, very, very popular character in the books. And I didn't have this in Outlander because I wasn't on social media, but also Ian Murray's a different sort of beast. Like Gallo Glass has big expectations about him.
Yeah.
And like a lot of the fans I kept reading had wanted people like Jason Momoa, which I thought was very funny. One being that Jason Momoa is a big movie star now and isn't going to be doing that anyway, but also Jason Momoa is Hawaiian. And very dark featured and dark haired. And he kept getting suggested by the fans as a blue eyed, blonde Scottish Viking. And people like Alexander Skarsgård and stuff, because they're all quite big and muscular. And I kept reading comments like saying, you know, don't really know who this guy is or whatever, but why have they cast, I'm disappointed they've cast somebody so tiny, or why have they cast someone so small, or why haven't they cast somebody more muscular, or da 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 da. And I kept reading those and I was like, right, one, I'm 5 feet 10, so I'm not tiny. But two, I am actually quite fucking muscular and I'm in the gym all the time preparing for this part.
I'll be honest, that I did, like, I saw a pic of yourself, you know, and you've been training since the last time I saw you.
Thank you, Graham. Thank you. And I never feel pressured to show stuff like that. But I was just a bit annoyed because I was like, the show hasn't even been on TV yet. Like, give it a chance. And also, I do have, like, I actually am in pretty good shape. So I ended up posting a photo of myself in the gym on Instagram. I felt like an absolute dick, and I still do feel like a dick for doing it because that's not my style, and I don't really do stuff like that. But I just thought, you know what? Maybe if some of them see that, it will appease them slightly. But you know what? You are in a hiding to nothing if you start getting into that, because you're never, ever, especially when it's a book adaptation, you're never going to please everyone, you know?
You know, there's always such massive fans, and they have their idea. They've read the book. They have their idea of that person. So it is, of course it's difficult.
It's pretty stupid getting into that. Anyway, and so the show is about this witch called Diana Bishop and the vampire Matthew, and a kind of like forbidden love between them, because witches and vampires cannot get together. And this forbidden love starts between them, and then they go on a quest for the Book of Life, which basically is a book that they believe tells the origins of witches and vampires and stuff, and there's other witches and vampires against them, and there's a bit of time traveling in series two. When I come into it, we're back in the Victorian times, and then in season three we're back in modern day times, and I'm a fucking legend.
I'm loving this review of the character as well. It's great.
Yeah.
Especially because we've heard some of your other reviews from Pantos and that. So it's great that this one's a fucking legend.
You know, he is in the books. He is a legend. He is an absolute, he's a cracking character in the books. I mean, whether or not he will be on screen, I don't know. But he's very, he's very entertaining in the books.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, mate. All right, that means it is last orders, Mr. Stephen Cree. And that can only mean one thing here on A Performer, A Pint and a Pod, that we do some quick fire questions so we can go and get you, what is it, a coconut latte before it shuts? Is that right?
Yeah, a coconut flat white, please.
A coconut flat white before it shuts, and I'll go and get myself another pint in. So, quick fire questions. First up, do you have a hidden talent?
I can do the splits just about.
Really?
Not as well as I used to be able to, but I can still, which is remarkable considering how tight my hamstrings are, but I can still just about do the splits.
Good stuff. Well, all right, next up we've got guilty pleasure.
TV wise or eating wise or what? Or
it could be anything at all. So it could be like a dodgy TV show, or if you want to do,
you're talking porn here, Graham. You can go that route.
I wouldn't know what you're talking about if you mentioned that. I just wouldn't know.
Right, okay.
So what is your guilty pleasure?
I mean, my God, like ice cream and chocolate is my downfall. Ben and Jerry's peanut butter cup ice cream is utterly phenomenal, and I will easily devour a full tub.
Right. Well, there we go. So basically Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Do you have a pet hate?
People being rude to waiters.
Ooh, that's a good one. I hate that. That is a pet hate of mine as well. Who is your favourite actor?
Oh, God. I don't have a favourite, but I love Joaquin Phoenix.
Okay. Sam will be gutted.
Sam Heughan. Sorry, Sam Heughan.
Favourite actress?
Kate Blanchett, Amy Adams.
Pick one.
I'll go with Kate Blanchett because I just saw her recently being phenomenal in Mrs. America.
Right, there we go. And who was your idol growing up?
Ted Neely.
Ted Neely?
He's the original Jesus in Jesus Christ Superstar.
Oh, really? What a
the movie.
What a shout. That's a brilliant one.
Yeah.
If you weren't an actor, what would you want to be?
I don't know. Scientist?
Scientist?
I was interested in, so there was a few things I was interested in when I was younger, like theology, science.
And you know what? Finally, we're going to chuck in one last one here. And this is from Morag Mackay Ellison. And she said, who was your biggest influence as a teenager?
I mean, like, 100%, like, definitely my mum, but also in terms of, like, where I got to, Fiona McKenzie, who was my music teacher when I was at secondary school or high school, as you say in the States. She was my music teacher, and without her, I don't think I would have gone on and done acting.
Fantastic. No, that was a very good question. It's almost like better questions coming in from Twitter than what I have. There we go. Thank you very much, Morag.
Thanks, Morag.
Just before you go, is there anything that you'd like to say that to watch out for coming up? Have you got any upcoming stuff that you'd like to mention?
Discovery Witches is going to be out this... I think it's going to be out, the second season. It's going to be out either the end of this year or the beginning of next year. I heard it was going to be December, but I still don't know for a fact. I am doing... This week, actually, I'm doing an extra day's filming on a film that I did last year called Martyrs Lane.
Right.
Which is a British independent horror film. Ghost story horror film. And I don't know when that'll be out because, you know, cinema and film is kind of very up in the air right now because of COVID.
Yeah, something to keep an eye out for. Martyrs Lane.
Martyrs Lane, yeah. Okay. Could be good, I think. Could be good. I hope so. So, yes, and that's it. And Star Force 3, obviously.
Of course. Star Force 3. Everyone do check that out on YouTube. Well, Mr. Stephen Cree, thank you very much for coming on A Performer, A Pint and a Pod.
Absolute pleasure. Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm going with my latte now.
Yeah, we'll get that coconut latte sorted out for you. So, there we go. That was Stephen Cree from being completely forgotten in additions to asking Gerard Butler and Mel Gibson what they would wear if they were a woman. What a character and what a career. Watch out for him starring as Galloglass in A Discovery of Witches. And of course, Star Force. I'll be meeting fantastic performers in the pub over the next few weeks and months with career-defining moments and secrets from behind the scenes. So make sure and don't miss out by subscribing to A Performer, A Pint and a Pod and follow at Performer Pint on socials. I've been your host, Graham Rooney. Thank you for listening. Please do rate and review. I love to hear your thoughts, unless, of course, you don't like me, then please do keep them to yourself. And remember, no one likes a stingy mate at the pub. So, share the pod with friends and family. See you next week.